From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The bid to unionize an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, fails by a wide margin as the federal government calls for a pause on Johnson & Johnson's COVID vaccine. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. Advocates of labor unions had hoped that this vote among workers at the Alabama warehouse of Amazon would be a watershed moment. But in the end, the election, Bill, was not even close. About 71% of the ballots said no to unionizing. And of course, not everybody voted. But if you look at the facility's total workforce, the journal's news pages ran those numbers, and only 16% of overall workers voted in favor of joining the union. So, Bill, what do you make of that, which is really a striking result?
Yes, it's extraordinarily striking. Well, I read that the workers there are basically satisfied with their employer. And it's not just that the vote went against the union, it was just so overwhelming. And so what you have is you have a company making an offer and you have the union making an offer, and the workers thought they would get a better deal from the company, that they had been treated pretty regularly, pretty well, healthcare and benefits and so forth. And I think this has ramifications, not just with Apple's other plants, but with unionization drives around the country. A lot of people are calculating the unions do not represent their best interests, and they want out or they don't want in. And it's, you know, as you've pointed out before, in a sense, this is just a long operating trend of, you know, a peak of union membership, I believe in the 50s or something, you know, when everyone pictured a union member as kind of a hard hat and so forth. And now the truth is that the real unions are the public sector unions, and the private sector unions, I think it's about 6% of the private sector is unionized. This is a long trend, and I think it's because, like companies don't serve their customers, a lot of unions haven't been putting the interests of their members first.
I have some of those numbers, and we'll get to those on broader unionization in a moment. But on the point about Amazon being the deal that Amazon offers its workers, the company talks about how its starting wage is $15 an hour. And you can compare that to the minimum wage in Alabama and federally of $7.25. And there were some really notable quotes, Kim, after the vote. So there was one worker who told the Washington Post, she said, "Amazon is the only job I know where they pay your health insurance from day one."
Yeah. And we quoted that particular woman. Her name was Lavinette Stokes in our editorial as well. And one of the other points that she made, not just about the fact that they pay your health insurance, they have benefits, they have a good starting wage, but she disliked that. And this is what we wrote, that organizers tried to cast this drive as an extension of Black Lives Matter, because a lot of the workers at that particular plant are Black. And she resented that. She said, "This is not an African American issue." You had a lot of other reports of workers saying that they were concerned that if the union got in, that they would put demands out there that actually cause Amazon to shed jobs. So they were worried about worker security. They didn't necessarily think that union organizers were able to get them much more than what they are getting now. You know, and I think that this generally reflects the view of a lot of people in the country about unionization. And it's a reflection of unions and the way they've shifted. Unfortunately, too many unions don't necessarily work to get the people they represent better pay or better jobs. They impose a lot of complex internal rules about seniority, et cetera, that actually make it harder for people to advance on the basis of their own merit. And they engage a lot in social causes. And people didn't like the idea, this was also quoted a lot, the notion of all that dues money being taken out of their check and potentially used on causes with which people don't agree.
or even just taken out of their check and not being an effective use of that money. That was another quote I pulled out from a journal article, a worker who said, "I work hard for my money. I don't want any of it going to a union that maybe can get us more pay or maybe can get us longer breaks. It's not worth the risk." And that bill, I think, goes to your point about, you know, even if there's something that you think could be better at your workplace, to vote yes in an election like this, you have to see a straight line between the change you want and the union getting that change. And that clearly was not obvious to a lot of these employees.
Well, one thing, Kyle, you know, we talked about the long trend line away from unions in the private sector. One of it is that corporate leaders have learned a lot too, that, you know, in the past, you know, the image of unions and bosses are a big labor capital clashes, you know, at factories, fights and calling in the cops and so forth. And I think these days employers learn that their employees are their chief asset and they try to keep them. So I don't think we have quite the antagonisms that we had before. But what you say is more or less a price calculation, right? If you'd say, I have a pretty good deal. If we unionize, I'm going to have to turn over X percent of my paycheck each month. And clearly in Amazon, they just decided this was not a price worth paying.
But the broader context here, which is part of what makes this so interesting, is that Amazon is now the second largest private employer in the United States. It has something like 800,000 workers and 800 warehouses around the country. I don't think any of them, those warehouses, are unionized. And so, Kim, the hope here, I think, among the labor unions had been to start with this election in Alabama, win it. Maybe it's close, maybe it's resounding, and you take that model to all of these other warehouses, and then you can start to push that percentage of unionized workers that's fallen so much in recent decades, start push that back up and make labor unions part of the landscape, the labor landscape again.
Yeah, I mean, as Joe Biden likes to say, you want to build back better. And that was, I heard that phrase used in the context of this, is that as we come out of this pandemic, you know, this needs to be one of the major priorities is union jobs. Because the reality, and to get to those numbers, and I think Bill mentioned them, you go back to 1973, about 24.2% of workers in the private sector were unionized. And that number is down to about 6.3% now. And this has been a big concern for labor unions. Yes, they've done better in the public sector, but in the private sector, that number tends to go down year by year by year. And so this was the strategy, and it's why so much attention was focused on this one plant, is start here, get it unionized, and start spreading the model across the country in, as you know, one of the biggest employers out there. This is a huge blow to that, and not just to the union itself that was attempting to do this organization, but, you know, to the Biden administration as well and others that are trying so desperately to pass a lot of this pro-union legislation in Washington, like the PRO Act, because, you know, this is a resounding message. The people don't want that. And actually, if I were a Democrat, I'd be a bit concerned about pushing it so hard, given the sentiment that exists among so many private sector employees.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of The Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim mentioned politicians who have seemed to misread this moment, and I have two of them that I've picked out. And the first bill is Joe Biden, As Kim says, he's talked a lot through his Build Back Better plans about union jobs. And he went out on a limb last month specifically in a video to sort of subtly encourage the Amazon workers to vote yes. And here's part of what he said. He said, "Today and over the next few days and weeks, workers in Alabama and all across the country are voting on whether to organize a union in their workplace. This is vitally important, a vitally important choice as America grapples with the pandemic, the economic crisis, and the reckoning on race," unquote. And as those numbers, the final election numbers, 71% of the people who voted no. I mean, Bill, it suggests to me that he has misread this a little bit.
Yeah, I think in a way, you know, he's a man of his time. Joe is always talking about not where he's from, but where he was born, Scranton, PA, which was always sort of one of the icons of the old economy, unionized economy, coal workers and so forth. And I think that's what he has his mind. And he's very, you know, he's very friendly with the labor unions, the private sector labor unions too. And I think that's the vision he has. And so far, so much of his agenda has been pushed by this, by trying to restore the unions to their place in the private sector. But to do it, they kind of have to squeeze other people out and deny other people rights. You know, I mean, it's a new day. Not only is the private sector sort of losing union workers while the government sector is gaining them. The Supreme Court has, you know, emphasized that all workers have these rights. You can't take their dues for, you can't force them to pay dues to a union they don't support. So I think this is a very old-fashioned vision that he has of an economy and how it should work.
And the second politician that I'll pick out is Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, who it seems to me was trying to capture some of the populist Trump mantle. And he wrote an op-ed that said this: "When the conflict is between working Americans and a company whose leadership has decided to wage culture war against working class values, the choice is easy. I support the workers, and that's why I stand with those at Amazon's Bessemer warehouse today," unquote. And Kim, come to find out, the workers at the Bessemer warehouse don't stand with Marco Rubio.
Yeah, I thought this was a real miss by Rubio, who, you know, look, there's a lot of people that are going to be angling for the presidential nod. He seems to be gearing up to run again and is out there very aggressively making a lot of statements on a lot of different issues. And this one made my eyebrows go up. It's pretty clear that one of the reasons he endorsed that drive was as a response to Amazon's censorship of conservatives, like conservative books, for instance. And Jeff Bezos, obviously the owner of Amazon, is a big liberal and who's been a thorn in the side of Republicans. And so he's become a bit of a hated figure. So some of it was driven by that. But he tried to cast it as, you know, populist Rubio standing arm in arm with the working class, and clearly that's not the working class priority, is not having a union foisted on them. So a little bit of an embarrassment for him there. There are plenty of other better ways for Republicans to stand in solidarity with working class people, including on quest economic policy, regulations, taxation, and in fact, being the guy or the people that in fact support workers' rights, which is defined as not being tyrannized by a union, not being subject to things like the PRO Act and card check and other techniques that unions use to sort of rig the game and get a union and intimidate people into doing a union. Those are the sort of things that I think workers would appreciate more.
Well, the union here in Alabama is not giving up and is using exactly that argument, saying that the workers here were intimidated by Amazon. So I guess it's the reverse argument of what Kim said. And they say that they're going to appeal to the National Labor Relations Board, claiming essentially that the election wasn't fair. I mean, Bill, do you think there's anything to that, or is this just sour grapes?
Sounds a little like Donald Trump to me, right? The election went the other way, ergo it was stolen. Look, the margin is so large. They had 2 months to vote. I mean, by any of the election rules, this was sort of free and open election. So I don't think they're going to get too far with this. I'm not surprised that this is what they're doing, but I don't see this going too far.
Other Democrats are taking this as an opportunity to say, this is an example of why we need the PRO Act, which you've mentioned a couple times, Kim, and that's an acronym for the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. What exactly is in that bill, and how would it change the landscape of these elections?
Well, fundamentally, it's a bill. There are a lot of different provisions in it, but it's a bill that gives overall unions the whip hand in these kind of organizational campaigns. And, you know, I'll give you just one example. One of the complaints about the Amazon vote in Alabama, and one of the things that the union is complaining about is that they're unhappy that Amazon was able to speak to workers. They actually held informational meetings in which they made their case for why workers might not want a union. And unions hate that. And so the PRO Act is essentially, there are provisions in there, for instance, that made it exceptionally difficult for employers to actually interact with employees on the question of unionization, whereas would give all these tools to unions to allow them to harass people over their phones and in their homes. That would give them contact information. That's just one small example of what is in there. But you know, there are other things that would, it was essentially on a case by case basis, allow the NLRB to impose card check, which is a process in which, for instance, in Alabama, the vote was by secret ballot with sealed envelopes, which is how we Americans expect to be able to vote without fear of retaliation. In a card check system, you basically, the union reps go around with this card and demand you sign your name. And when you finally get enough people on it, then your union is formed. And they, you know, they can kind of publicly harass you and make your life miserable if you don't put your name on the card. It's a terrible method. And we've seen unions turn to these kind of tactics because they are having such trouble convincing people. So once you can't convince people with the argument, you have to go to rigging the game to make it easier to get what you want. I think one of the problems with those that are arguing for the PRO Act is that it would be one thing if this was a close election. And then maybe you could have argued that something that Amazon did was enough to push it over the edge. But this was such a resounding and humiliating defeat that it's going to be really hard to argue that, oh, all you need is a little bit better playing field.
But what's interesting also about the strategy to pass the PRO Act is that President Biden has made this part of his overall infrastructure package. I mean, there's a lot of negotiations going on about what will go in and what will go out, but whatever comes out of those negotiations is undoubtedly going to be an enormous bill with lots and lots of pages and things tacked on here and there. And so is that something, Bill, that you can foresee the PRO Act being in there, or is this one of those things that can't possibly make it through the budget reconciliation process, so it has to be done with 60 votes?
If I were saying objectively, that would be my position. It doesn't look like the kind of thing that could be done there. I don't know. I think they will pursue it separately. It's a popular thing among Democratic activists. Look what they did in California with AB5, pretty similar thing. I mean, you're basically recategorizing a lot of independent contractors into employees, which of course reduces, you know, the number of employees overall. You know, the other aspect of this that I think is incredibly unwise is that the PRO Act is designed to go after these people, these pockets, these independent contractors, and force them to be turned into employees where they can be better unionized and so forth. But one of the advantages of these independent contractors, and I think there are 57 million people that consider themselves freelancers of some sort in America, they're very flexible. I mean, they have a lot of flexibility because they determine their work hours, when they work, where they work, how they work, and so forth, not necessarily all the time. And that really proved its worth during the COVID crisis as people stayed home and we needed a lot more flexibility in our system. And to kind of take away that flexibility now, which I think has proved its worth, is really a very bad sign for the future. And I think Joe Biden and the Democrats are being very casual about this, because this is something, again, the unions want. You know, for all President Biden's emphasis, I'm going to be transformational and so forth, he does seem to want to be transformational, but to take us back to the 1950s.
Finally, a bit of breaking news here. On Tuesday, the federal government called for a pause in using the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. Kim, what's the story here?
Well, basically, the story is that the FDA is pausing the use of J&J vaccine because of this particular type of blood clotting that's happening. And it's a blood clot in the brain's venous sinuses. It's so far, I want to be really clear, it's occurred in 6 people out of more than 6 million doses that are administered. And there has to yet so far been no cause and effect relationships absolutely established. Because the usual occurrence of this, we should point out, the usual occurrence of this condition is about 5 in 1 million. So you've got 6 people out of 6 million. It's 1 out of, you know, every million. So we can't say for absolute certain that it's being caused by the COVID vaccine. What has people concerned is that all of the cases have occurred in females age 18 to 48. There are no males and no other age groups. This type of clotting is very unusual. It's known to usually occur in young people, including like newborns and pregnant women. So that has some doctors worried that, given all of those factors, it's not a coincidence. And so they're taking a pause. They're going to look through all the data and try to get a better idea. I think there's also a goal of, you know, this is a, like I said, a very rare condition that requires a certain kind of treatment. So there might be an opportunity here to advise doctors on it. But it does raise some really interesting questions too about whether or not this is going to, you know, spark more hesitancy among the public about taking vaccines in general.
Right. I mean, Bill, what do you make of the pause here? The federal, I think it was a recommendation, was how the federal guidance was framed. But it seems to be being taken on board. CVS, Walgreens, both of them are doing a lot of vaccines, have said they'll stop the Johnson & Johnson shot. So, I mean, what do you make of the approach here if we don't know what's going on with this very rare occurrence? Doing a pause, the acting commissioner of the FDA says the pause may only last a matter of days, though it's not clear.
Right. Well, I think it's not clear because we need more information. I mean, on the one hand, I'm not really opposed to a pause. It seems reasonable. Let's gather a little more information. On the other hand, what's often missing from all these kind of questions is some kind of perspective. What is the norm in these cases? Is this an alarming departure from the norm that we're seeing a lot more? Or is it kind of what we would expect from a mass vaccination? You know, there's sort of this implicit belief out there that we can reduce risk 100%. And the reality is that life is about calculating risks and seeing what's better and weighing things one way or the other. I don't mind if they take a few days to just look over the information again, see if we can determine more. But I'm hoping that when they do, it will not be against some absolute measure.
Well, I guess two thoughts of that prompt. One, Kim, is that there's also an opportunity cost. I mean, we're in the middle of what is always described as a global pandemic, a very serious health crisis that has had a lot of consequences for people who've gotten the virus and for people who haven't. And pausing, depending on how long the pause lasts, for a very rare risk means also you're not giving the vaccine to a ton of people who would not have that rare side effect and would get the benefits of it and maybe would not get COVID.
Right. You know, and all of this is reminding me, we've had variations of this discussion with vaccines for decades. I remember writing a lot for the journal about the claims that childhood vaccines caused autism. There was no evidence, but here's the fundamental problem. Whenever you're going out and you're giving a vaccine to vast pieces of a community. Or in this case, pretty much the entire country is your goal. We don't have it approved yet for younger kids, but you know, you're looking to vaccinate. It means that everyone's getting it. And it means that it becomes very easy to sort of say that anything that then happens to anyone is caused by it, even though establishing that cause and effect is actually very difficult to do. You know, on any given day, a lot of people are going to have heart attacks. A lot of people are going to have strokes. A lot of people are going to come down with cancer. You know, did they have their COVID shot the day before? You know, is it, does it lead to kind of these fears that that's why it happened? And it becomes very easy then for people to become very worried about something, especially when rumors and now in the age of social media, the fear factor just grows and grows. And so I do worry about this. Like Bill said, the most important thing needs to be talking about relative risk. I think the real worry here is that, you know, there's a lot of folks that could be getting COVID and have much worse outcomes than they would in any risk to them of taking a vaccine.
Right. And also the other thought that I had was just that if we don't know that this is linked at all, if it turns out that it's not linked, it could be that the pause in the announcement of it creates more vaccine hesitancy among people who would not maybe have seen that there was any questions of any links at all. So, but hopefully the pause will be short, and hopefully there will be no link found, and we'll get back to vaccinating people here within a few days. But thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.